Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is journalist, writer, and editor Harriet Brown. Brown is an assistant professor of magazine journalism at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communication in Syracuse, New York. She specializes in writing about issues that affect the lives of women and children, and her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, O Magazine, Health, and Vogue. She is also a frequent contributor to the Tuesday New York Times science section. Her most recent book, and the one we'll be discussing today, is called Brave Girl Eating, A Family Struggle with Anorexia, and it was published by William Morrow. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I have to say, this is one of the most amazing books I've read about anorexia. So let's start in the beginning. Your daughter, Kitty, was diagnosed with anorexia at the age of 14. Tell us what you were noticing, what some of the symptoms were.
We didn't notice much. The main thing we noticed was she suddenly became very anxious, and she was not an anxious child at all. So a kid who happily went off to 2 weeks of sleepaway camp at age 8 without a look back, bye mom, doing great, suddenly couldn't ride a bike for 5 minutes with us on a family bike ride without bursting into tears, you know, couldn't go to sleep alone at night, had all these, you know, anxieties. And we talked with her about it, and, you know, all she would say is she was worried that she might have OCD. She had a teacher in school, she was in eighth grade, who had OCD and who had been pretty open with the kids about it.
Yeah, tell people what OCD is.
OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And I said, why do you think you have that? And she said, because I worry about things a lot. And I said, what kind of things? And she wouldn't say. So my husband and I, we offered to go to therapy. She didn't want that, so we thought we'd just keep an eye on her. And then as we watched her, from then on, it was a pretty quick progression. We noticed she wasn't eating that much. I thought to have anorexia, you had to lose a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the signs I was looking for and didn't see. It turned out for her, like for a lot of young teenagers and children, you can just not gain weight when you should. So you never actually drop on the scale. You simply grow and don't gain weight. And in fact, that had happened to her just about 6 months before that. You know, she'd been to the pediatrician for a checkup, and she hadn't gained any weight in a year, and she'd grown. And I remembered asking the pediatrician, like, hey, isn't there something wrong with this? And she, you know, reassured me, no, it's fine, it's normal. I mean, she couldn't have known at that point, but in retrospect...
And also, kids often do grow and
then
don't gain weight.
That's,
you know,
right.
That's a normal...
They grow in all different ways,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So within about 3 weeks of that first noticing of the anxiety, I was pretty sure that we were dealing with anorexia. In the meantime, I was, you know, frantically reading everything I could. And
Well, tell us what anorexia actually is. I know it manifests itself in many different ways, but tell us what the clinical version is.
Well, the clinical definition of it, it's a whole list of characteristics, including the first one, a refusal to maintain a body weight of at least, you know, 85% of your ideal body weight. And that's an interesting definition because I think it's wrong, and actually it's going to be changed in the next edition of the DSM to say an inability to maintain a body weight. What we understand about it now is that it is genetic, biological, neurobiological. There's a whole lot of things that come together, but what it basically becomes is people become terrified of eating, and they are under huge compulsions not to eat, and when they do eat, they feel enormous guilt and anxiety. So I think it's basically an anxiety disorder.
Yeah, it sounds like it, yeah.
And it also has a lot of overlap with OCD, in fact.
Uh-huh.
There's obsessive thinking and so on, but there's clearly a genetic component to
uh-huh.
it.
Well, once you realize that your daughter did have anorexia, tell us about some of the challenges you faced in finding help.
Yeah. You know how it is when you're a parent and you have a child and, you know, you take them to the doctor and, okay, this is what they have. And you're like, okay, we know what we're dealing with. Let's fix it. It isn't that way with eating disorders.
Yeah.
There's no fix. And it took me and my husband a long time to kind of go, what do you mean no fix? You know, I mean, there are fixes. There's advice. Take her home. Try to get her to eat. Find a therapist. Well, we'd been trying to get her to eat for several weeks at that point, or a month at that point, and we weren't having any luck. And trying to get her to eat wasn't helpful. To even find a therapist who dealt with eating disorders in our town, or frankly in any town, it's really unusual to have access to good providers. And then to find a therapist who was any good was even
exactly.
harder.
And but how was your daughter reacting to this, though? I mean, was she admitting that she needed some help? Well, what about the resistance of the patient in regard to, you know, thinking they need help?
Yeah, you don't know that you need help when you have anorexia and other eating disorders. It's what we call anosognosic, which is a fancy word meaning your brain can't identify that this is a problem. The behaviors seem positive to you when you have them. And I think that is why a lot of people have mischaracterized the illness for so long. Oh, these kids are just oppositional. They're resistant. They're rebellious. They're just manipulative. No, none of that is actually, I mean, some of that may be true for some kids, but
yeah.
That's not the illness. The illness is, I can't see that I'm...
Yeah, and you know, we used to hear in the old days, I don't know if this has turned out to be true, but we used to hear that these kids were trying to be in control of their lives. You know,
right.
by not eating.
That's one of the biggest misconceptions and one of the ways in which it was blamed on parents. Well, we have, you know, over-controlling parents, so the only way this child can develop autonomy is by not eating. And I think one reason people thought that is because one of the big peaks of onset is early adolescence, 13, 14, when what are you doing? Developmentally, you're becoming, starting
you are
to become
trying
more
to separate.
Autonomous.
Yes, yeah.
But in fact, anorexia takes away all your control. Because the person who has anorexia and other eating disorders has no control. They are obsessed with things. They can't turn it off. They can't stop it. One young woman once described it to me as, it's like I have an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other, and all day long they're fighting with each other, and I can't do anything but listen to them.
Wow, isn't that amazing? So that proves that it is a psychological disease in many ways.
Well, it has psychological components, mm-hmm. but I actually think it's a physiological illness.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with genetics. Like a lot of people say, well, media is to blame. If media caused eating disorders, I think we would all have them.
Exactly.
Because we're all exposed to this, you know, very destructive media. Why is it that only one or two, and mostly girls out of 100, develop anorexia? I think, not me, but what researchers think, is that the other 98 don't have the genetic and neurobiological underpinning.
Uh-huh.
So they're not vulnerable in the same way. They're vulnerable to, you know, distorted thinking and disordered eating, but not to actually becoming
a real anorexic. Now you finally found a treatment plan called family-based treatment, and this was a huge revelation for you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, it was a revelation because our pediatrician was great, but about a month after the diagnosis, our daughter wound up in the hospital with dehydration and a very low heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
So she was there for 5 days, kind of getting medically stabilized, and the looks that the doctors gave us, the comments we heard. As a parent, you get this feeling like, oh my God, this is all my fault. And frankly, you feel that way anyway, because any time your child is struggling with something, you tend to feel that way. What have mm-hmm. I done? What could I have done differently?
Oh, yeah.
And so one of the main components of traditional treatment is, I mean, we were actually told this. Now, Mom, don't be the food police. Don't talk about food. Find other things to talk about. Really? My daughter's starving to death. And you want me to not talk about food? That does not make any sense to me.
Exactly.
So family-based treatment, which was developed in London in the 1980s, has a different approach. It says, look, we don't really understand everything that goes into causing an eating disorder, but it's not helpful to try to understand it. Let's set that over here, and let's think about what do people need to get better? Because frankly, the recovery rates are abysmal. They're less than 50%. 20% of people with anorexia die over the course of 20 years.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
got the highest mortality of any psychiatric illness.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
So what can we do to help? Well, you can't get better until you eat and gain weight. So what do people need to do that when it's obviously so terrifying to them to do it? So family-based treatment basically says, you can't fight the voice in your head that screams at you not to eat by yourself. You need other people to basically compel you, encourage you, support you, lovingly but firmly get you to eat even when you can't.
Yeah.
And that's a way forward. And who does a teenager have who can do that? 99 times out of 100, it's their family.
Yeah. Because I think they used to almost punish kids when they got this kind of an illness.
Oh, absolutely. People still do.
Yeah.
There are many
yeah.
treatment programs. I hear stories all the time. And I think it's from a misguided sense of what the illness is about. Well, if you don't eat, then you can't talk to your parents. And I understand that because we had to do things that felt like that. I think it's a lot has to do with how you do it. if it feels punitive, it's not going to be successful.
Exactly.
It has to come out of love and support and encouragement.
You know, I remember when I was a teenager, or not a teenager, probably a young adult, we used to hear that anorexia was coming out of privileged children's homes, and these kids were, you know, were supposed to overachieve and stuff. I mean, that's not necessarily true either. That was another crazy way to sort of punish people.
Right. Eating disorders occur across all ethnicities, all socioeconomic statuses. What is true, interestingly, is that there seem to be personality traits that are associated with it. And when we say traits, those are things that you're born with. They're not things that are changeable depending on your mood or your maturity level.
Uh-huh.
For example, my daughter, she is a perfectionist. She's always been that way.
Mm.
Was it because people pressured her to do everything perfect? No. Our other daughter doesn't do that at all. And that's probably part of the genetics that we don't understand yet.
Mm.
Certain personality traits, perfectionism, wanting to overachieve, and people-pleasing. Those are the big ones. And they are associated, especially with anorexia. Bulimia has some different traits associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? So
yeah,
we
exactly.
don't really know the answer.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Kitty's personality change. I mean, you talk almost like she sounded like she was possessed. You said her voice would change, her eyes would stare blankly. Tell us about these personality changes.
Oh, we were terrified the first time we saw it. It was like watching The Exorcist, that movie.
Now, you describe that in the book, and that's exactly what it sounded like.
When she was really, really ill and really in the thick of it, it was like an alternate personality. And it changed everything, her affect, her tone of voice. She would flick her tongue in and out of her mouth like a snake. You know, and the first time that happened, I thought she was sticking her tongue out at me. And then I realized she didn't even know she was doing it. So it was like seeing...
But this was like spells, though. She wasn't always behaving like this, right?
No.
Would it happen when you would bring up food, or you never knew?
It usually happened when we were trying to get her particularly to eat something or drink something that,
uh-huh.
you know, and it would just, she would just snap.
Oh,
I mean, if you talk to her about anything else, she was completely rational, fine. She would joke. She was herself. I think that's another reason why families tend not to understand there's a big problem right away. I said, what do you mean? We're talking, you know, she's fine on every other subject.
Yeah, yeah. And then people do expect adolescents to behave strangely.
They do.
We have to admit that.
They do.
Now, the statistics that you have in your book and that I've read, too, is that it sometimes can take 5 to 7 years to recover and so on. And do you find this to be true? And I also hear that people never recover like alcoholics. They're always fighting this.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to say really strongly is that that's not true.
Good.
People absolutely recover 100%. Does every person recover 100%? No. I think the best outcomes happen when you catch it early and you treat it very aggressively. So the less time a person spends under the spell of an eating disorder and malnourished or purging or whatever their behaviors are, the easier. But I also know people who were sick for 10 years, 15 years, who did recover fully. Using family-based treatment, even in their 20s and 30s.
Uh-huh.
So are there people who are chronically ill? Yes. And I think that that's why we need more research dollars on the adolescent side, because I do think once you're a chronically ill adult, it's harder to recover, but still possible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harriet Brown. We're talking about her book, Brave Girl Eating, A Family Struggle with Anorexia. I wanted to talk to you about the fact that the physical process of starvation actually changes people's brains. And that's another reason why these kids can't be left on their own to try to recover on their own. Tell us about some of the ways that you dealt with that. I mean, how did you get her to eat with this kind of changed brain? Yeah.
And especially because we were trying to get her to eat without any success. And then we sort of embarked on this family-based treatment, and we did it without a therapist who was trained in the method, so we were kind of doing it on our own with support from people who were supportive but not particularly knowledgeable. And I think that the main component is this treatment empowers the family. It says to the family, not only should you be talking about food and eating, it's your job to make sure to find ways to support your child to eat. And that's different for every kid. So for example, we were kind of lucky that she had that medical, you know, wound up in the hospital dehydrated, because they wanted to put in a feeding tube while we were there.
Oh, God.
And she did not want that. Mm-hmm. She was terrified of that. So after she got out, we were able to use that in a way as a stick. You know, you need like a carrot and a stick. And again, not in a punitive way, but in a matter-of-fact way. Okay, if you can't eat this, and I really understand that it's hard for you and that you're terrified, and I'm right here with you, but if our support isn't enough, we will have to go back to the hospital for a tube, because the one thing that's not negotiable is you're not going to starve. We're going to take care of you.
We're not going to let you starve. How did the family, I mean, the family dynamic had to have changed. Did you all end up having to play these roles just in support of Kitty? I know you have a younger daughter, too.
Yeah,
how did this change the family dynamic?
It did change our family dynamic. I think it changed it permanently, actually.
Uh-huh.
We tried to keep our younger daughter separate. It was very hard on her.
Oh,
she was 10 at the time and very smart. In fact, I think she knew her sister was ill before we knew. I think she had an idea of what it was before I did.
Ah.
You know, kids, they're tuned in. And so, you know, we did try to separate them, but there's no question that a lot of the family energy and attention went to saving our older daughter's life.
Well, what was it like at the dinner table, though? I mean, obviously, you weren't keeping the girls separated when you were trying to have meals.
Sometimes we did separate
them,
yeah, because meal times were the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just depend. Sometimes it would be okay. But usually if Kitty was struggling, you know, or if she struggled before and during and after, there could be a lot of tears. You know, she talked about wanting to kill herself. There was a lot of pain surfacing. And so one of the things I promised myself while we were doing this was that once we got through it, I was going to throw away that kitchen table. I never wanted to see it again. And in fact, we did that.
Did you do that? Because I remember you mentioned that in the book.
Out on the curb it went.
Now, you point out that mental illness labels people as their disease, you know, and unlike heart disease, somebody's an anorexic or a bulimic, like it's their whole identity. Talk to us about how much that angers you.
I think that it's not helpful, and I think that it's a subtle form of blaming the person for what they have. You're an anorexic. There's nothing of you except anorexia, which is not true. And I think that we still do blame people subtly, not overtly anymore. I mean, people used to think if you touch someone with mental illness, you could catch it.
Oh, yeah, I remember those days. Yep.
We're not that far away from those days, really, the way we treat people.
Yeah. So. Well, I think our medical insurance and our medical system treats mental and physical separately. And I have friends in Europe who cannot believe that those are considered separate, you know, the mind and the body.
Exactly.
And so we have done that to ourselves by separating it just in those terms, the way we treat.
Descartes has a lot to answer for. Mind and body, they go together. They're not separate. And anorexia and other eating disorders are really interesting because they kind of are at the nexus of physical and psychological. You know, there's definitely parts of each in them. You can't say it's all one or the other.
Exactly. Treating it separately makes no sense to me.
No, and that's, you know, traditional treatment says, well, when we get to the root of the problem, then the person will be able to choose to eat. And that's BS. That just isn't true.
Well, your experience did teach you that a child in the throes of anorexia cannot take responsibility for herself or her life.
No, not at all. That you're cognitively impaired both by the anorexia and by the malnutrition. And if there's purging involved by the shifts in electrolytes, you know, that all changes your brain. I mean, in the book I wrote about an experiment done in the 40s by Ansel Keys, a researcher in Minnesota who starved men and then refed them. This was, you know, World War II, and people were really interested in sort of how to help people from camps and from starving, you know, European countries.
Mm-hmm.
And what he observed was that the physical, and these men weren't anorexic, but the physical effects of malnutrition for a lot of them, if not most of them, included all of the psychological effects we associate with anorexia. So the men became very conscious of appearance. They became obsessed. They started cutting up their food in little pieces. Sometimes they wouldn't eat even the little bit they were allowed to eat.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah, and I was interested in that when you talked about that in the book.
Yeah.
How important, if at all, was Kitty needing to have her friends around her? Did they abandon her? Were they able to support her? Tell us.
They did abandon her, and I think that that's fairly common. I certainly know other groups where that doesn't happen, and I think, you know, one of the psychological elements of an eating disorder is you tend to isolate yourself, partly because what do friends do together? They eat. They go out to eat. Food greases the social wheels.
Yeah, for children and adults.
Yes,
yeah, indeed.
For all of us. Mm-hmm. We learned that very much. And so if you're afraid of eating, if you don't want to be in a situation where people will notice that you're not eating, you isolate yourself. You don't go to the parties. You don't go on the trips. You don't go out with your friends. And in her case, they stopped calling. And I think 14-year-olds, they're all struggling with something, even if it's not some big pathology.
But do you think it goes back to the parents, perhaps, afraid of the mental illness label and afraid that kids being around somebody who's mentally ill might make them unsafe or something?
I mean, no, because I don't think teenagers necessarily do what their parents want them to do about that kind of thing. I just think it's like, oh, she's weird. She's got problems. I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, yeah. And I've heard about a lot of people being abandoned when they get any kind of an illness, period.
Especially mental illness, though.
Especially,
I mean, if you have
yeah.
a physical illness, people can come visit you in the hospital. They can send you flowers. They can talk about it. See, people don't even want to talk about this.
Yeah. Well, I think they're afraid they don't know what to say.
Yep.
You know, that kind of thing.
They are.
Well, let's go back to the cultural influences, though. I know that isn't the primary reason why people get anorexia, but how much do you think that does affect young women in this culture?
Oh, hugely. There's mm-hmm. no question that mm-hmm. it affects young women and increasingly young men. And it can be a huge trigger. One of the things we're seeing now is not necessarily more cases of anorexia, but they're developing earlier. So it used to be 13, 14, now it's 8, 9, 10, 5, 6. And I think that you can look to the culture for that, because if you've got the underlying vulnerabilities, they're going to be triggered earlier, because 5-year-olds are looking at a lot of media, they're consuming a lot of media, they're very self-aware, they call each other fat. Now there's this whole additional level of, you know, the obesity epidemic, the war on obesity, you know, posters up in schools, health classes, everybody talking about how bad it is to be fat.
Yeah, I know. It's going around the other way in extreme again. Exactly the way anorexia was. You said that you think we're locked in a war with our own hunger, which I thought was a really interesting line. Tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Well, as a friend of mine once told me, you know, if I could scrape the taste buds off my tongue, I would do that. Because then, and what she was saying was, she has this conflict that she can't resolve between liking food and wanting to eat and wanting to be thin, and also feeling like she shouldn't like to eat. And I think we have this very puritanical sense that we shouldn't like to eat. That eating, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say things like, well, we should eat to survive. We should just eat to live. And I'm like, really?
Goodness.
Eating is one of the pleasures of life. What is wrong with that? We're hardwired to like eating because it keeps us alive.
Yeah.
But our culture does not support that at all. And so,
But you know what's so strange about our culture right now? We do have all these images and airbrushed models, and yet we have all these cooking shows now that everybody's talking about wanting to be on, starting all over cable. It's such a contradiction.
I think it reflects our ambivalence and the dichotomy that has sort of sprung up, good food, bad food, you know. And I think, again, when people are deprived or feel guilty about something, they often become obsessed with it. So it's, in a way, it's kind of a metaphor. You know, we shouldn't be eating this, but so let me drool over some food porn, you know, because I shouldn't be eating it. At least I could look at it or watch the show.
Yeah, it's such a strange time that we're living in regard to that. Well, I have to ask you this. How is Kitty doing now? It's 7 years. She's obviously a young woman now.
Mm-hmm.
How is she?
She's in college. She's well. She's not fully recovered yet, but I would say that she's physically well. She had a relapse at 18. But she's physically recovered and has come a long way mentally, too. So I think she has a life. She's got a boyfriend and studying to do something she really loves and has friends. So, you know, what I see is that she's still struggling with the thoughts some. And mm-hmm. I think that with time and support, she will improve there, too. But
What was the relapse like? Had she learned from the previous episodes how to deal with it better at that point?
No, in a way, I think it happened when she lived independently for the first time.
Mm.
And what she said afterwards was, you know, I just didn't want to think about it anymore. So it's not like, I think she went off and just tried to be, quote, normal like everyone else. But what normal was, you know, eating like everybody else, she lost weight.
Ah.
She was also an athlete.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I said to her, it's kind of like if you had diabetes, you'd have to check your blood sugar. You've got to check to make sure you're eating enough all the time.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, the relapse was harder because she was older and it almost felt more psychological in a way. There were more psychological repercussions. So,
yeah.
But she has worked super hard and been very brave and come a long way.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So why did you want to write this book, though? I mean, was it to help other people? How did Kitty feel about this?
Kitty was not totally thrilled when I said I wanted to write about it, but we talked about it a lot, and she finally gave her permission because she saw a lot of her friends struggling with it, and we both felt like we wanted other people to know about family-based treatment, so part of it was informational. I mean, a lot of pediatricians don't, a lot of doctors still don't even know about this. And the other thing was, I really wanted to change the way people see people with eating disorders, and that's why I gave it the title I did.
That's a great title.
I played with a lot of different titles, but in the end, what I want people to know is that someone with an eating disorder is not spoiled, is not acting out, is not manipulative, is not deceitful. They are brave because they are facing their hugest fears every day. You know, people who are alcoholic can stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
People have to keep eating.
That's right.
Or die.
That's right.
I think it takes a lot of courage, and I think we don't give people enough credit for that.
Yeah. What kind of reception have you gotten with this book? Have people come up to you and engaged you in conversation?
They have, you know, and it's been by and large very positive, and, you know, especially families who are looking for, you know, wait,
some kind of support,
what is happening?
Yeah.
I don't understand this. I think a lot of people give it to people to say, here, if you really want to understand what we're going through, read this. And then there are people who are a little bit hostile to the book who I think are still sick themselves, or parents whose kids went away to treatment and have been sick for a long time and, you know, I think feel bitter about the fact that they didn't know about this and they weren't given and they were blamed and now they blame themselves.
Yeah.
And
so they were upset because they didn't get the kind of tools that you actually
yeah.
offer people. Do you have any resources that you can give people right now on the air?
Yeah. This book started as a story for the New York Times Magazine, and when that came out, two other moms and I started a website that has resources for people, whether they're doing family-based treatment or not. It's just really helpful resources, and it's maudsleyparents.org.
Spell it out.
M-A-U-D-S-L-E-Y, parents, all one word, .org. And there's stories of other families and how they've coped. There's recipes. There's links to research. There's Q&A. There's all kinds of stuff on there. The National Eating Disorders Association is a really, really good resource, too. NationalEatingDisorders.org. And those are probably the two best resources.
Well, that's great. Well, Harriet Brown, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us. And really, this book is really one of the best I've read about this subject. It's called Brave Girl Eating, A Family Struggle with Anorexia. Go out and buy it. Help your community, help your children, help your neighbors. This is a great resource. Harriet Brown, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.